Go from there.
Okay.
Go ahead.
My name is Virginia Houston, and you can call me Ginny. I grew up in Boston, just outside of Boston, and I was a poor city kid, and had dreams of trees and horses and farm life and that type of thing. But I was very involved with, I went to the museum on Saturday and studied drawing and learned to paint. And I think, as I said to you earlier, I think that opens up your eyes to nature and what's around you. I worked very hard in school, and I started working from the time I was in the third grade after school, running errands. But I also learned at the same time that it's important to give back, because my mother would say, well, you can't charge so-and-so because they can't afford it. So that was a very strong lesson. And however, I saved $10,000 by the time I graduated from high school. And went to work for the president of Maryland Cup Corporation, which was Sweetheart Paper, Sweetheart Straws. And he had 7 to 10 stockbrokers calling him every day, because he was a very wealthy man. And so I started trading. I opened my own account and started trading in the market, and turned the $10,000 into a few million over time.
Wonderful story.
So a lot of ups and downs in the market, and obviously took a lot
terrific.
Of risk to do that. I'm now a financial consultant stockbroker at Smith Barney Shearson in Boston, and I primarily work with managed money, and I don't like people to take a lot of risk, but I tell them the turtle really wins the race. But I didn't have, you know, a family that I had to worry about. You know, so now I'm with money managers myself. But then I went into business for myself. I opened an art gallery on Newbury Street in Boston, because I always loved art and loved to paint and so forth. But I also knew that galleries don't typically make a lot of money, so I opened a paper store in Danvers at the same time, and I was buying imperfects from Sweetheart, mistrimmed plates, and because every plate has a rim, so that some were wider at one end and narrower at the other, and they would normally just, you know, toss those away, and they actually would regrind them, but it would cost them double to make the same plate, because they'd have to add virgin resin. And still, every so many plates, they'd have a mistrim. So I bought them and would repackage them and sell them to housewives who didn't care. The kids don't care if the plates are a little imperfect. And I couldn't get a loan because I didn't have a business background. So I put my own money in both enterprises. And it took me 3 years to get my money out of the art gallery. And took me 1 year out of the paper store. Very quick turnaround. And I had that for about 15 years, and Sweetheart eventually was sold to Fort Howard Paper, and the business was changing. Paperama went in up the street from me, very large operation. And I was being pursued by E.F. Hutton at the time to become a broker, because they were pretty much following my trades, because I was still trading very actively in the market. So I eventually closed the business, and I went into the financial business, which I've enjoyed. And we've been taken over twice, once by Shearson and now by Smith Barney. And
there's another small world.
Yeah. Anyway, I would continue, and as I was making money in the market, I bought my first home, which was in Boston on the waterfront, condominium, and then my next purchase was New Hampshire. I bought a bigger, more of a home, bigger house, still a townhouse condominium, and
around here or
in North Conway,
in North Conway,
New Hampshire. And I really love my home in New Hampshire. And but as the years went on, you know, it became very commercial in the town of North Conway, and the areas around me, people were, you know, they clear-cut the land, and it was a little heartbreaking to me to see the trees coming down and so on. And I thought, well, if I, you know, if I buy some land, then at least I have control over that land. I was also dating a guy who had a farm in South Natick, and I really fell in love with the lifestyle, but I didn't quite fall in love with him. So after we broke up, I was talking to one of my clients who had moved to New Hampshire, to Vermont, and when we finished talking about it, they called me up about business one day, and after we finished talking about business, I knew they ride, and I said, well, have you been riding lately, and how is that going, and how are the horses? And they said, well, the farm we usually ride through is being sold, and we hope that a developer doesn't buy it. And this was Waitsfield, Vermont. And I hadn't been to Sugarbush since I was in my early 20s. And I said to them, well, what are you doing for the weekend? Do you feel like company? And I'll come up, and if the farm's available, maybe I'll buy it. So they invited me up, and Saturday we saddled up the horses, and we went up Palmer Hill Road and around, and we came out on the back side of the property, and we looked out at this beautiful field and the mountains behind, and that was it for me. I was in love.
So that's where the land is, up there. Yes. I drove up there one day.
Yes.
And three deer came out of the meadow up there.
Yes, and, there's a lot of wildlife. Yeah. There's bear up there, deer, and, you know, what? Just... My dog Rigsy has gotten a mouthful of wreck.
Porcupine.
Yes, and anyway, I just felt that I felt like I came home. That's exactly how I felt. And so we rode up to the old farmhouse, and I introduced myself to the farmer. His name is Ken Austin. He's been back since he visited last summer. He stayed at the farmhouse, and so I keep in touch with him. And he moved to, I think, is it North Carolina or South Carolina, that area. But he had had the farm for, I think, a couple of generations. His mother had the farm before him. And anyway, I introduced myself, and he said the farm was under contract, though, to a developer. So I gave him my card, and I said, well, if it falls through, give me a call, and I'll buy the farm from you. And I never expected to hear from him again. So I went back to Boston and just sort of put it out of my mind. And a couple of weeks later, I got a call, and it was Ken Austin. And evidently, the developer had been perking along the Pine Brook River stream, and it didn't perk for the number of houses that he wanted to put down there. It perked for about half the amount. And so he withdrew his offer. And so I sent Ken a check, and that was it.
How many acres is it?
Originally, I bought 250 acres. That was the original property. And so it was a very easy transaction and no problems. And I told Ken he could continue to live there if he wanted to. And he did stay for a few months until, it got cool, and then he wanted to complete his move, so he left. And in August or September, I was trying out a horse on the property with my friends who I had originally seen the property with, and I fell and I broke my back. And because I was very nervous, it was 2 days before the market crashed in '87, and I knew it was going to come down unless the Fed eased. And so I probably shouldn't have been riding. You know, you don't ski when you're tired. You shouldn't ride when you're very, very uptight. And it was just a fluke accident, though. And I knew I broke it because I heard the snap. And my friends didn't think I broke it because I didn't lose movement in my leg, and I could feel everything. And I actually had to get back on the horse to get out of the woods.
Oh.
And Christina from the Icelandic horse farm. She was a doctor in Sweden, and she just, I'll never forget it, she ran her thumb down my back and she said, yes, you broke this vertebrae, and go to the hospital and they'll x-ray you, but they don't brace you anymore or anything like that. So I did. I went to the hospital, and originally, first they couldn't find the break under the x-ray. And I said to the doctor, don't you want to, feel my back? And he looked at me like I was crazy. But anyway, they sent me through again, and they said, oh, yes, you did break this vertebrae, and just go home and stay on your back. So I got my friends to drive me to Boston. They put a mattress in the back of my Jeep, drove me to Boston because I wanted to be at work the next day because I knew the market was going to crash. And so, mind you, I couldn't lift my pocketbook, but I shuffled to work. And it was pretty bad for quite a long time, but I couldn't really leave during the day to go out and get re-x-rayed because people were just panicking. So finally, 2.5 weeks later, I saw my doctor, and he said, yes, you did break your back, and I would tell you not to go to work, but since you're already doing that, just be careful. And I guess God protects fools and stockbrokers. Anyway, I would work all day, and I'd go home at night and lay on my back, and I really can't tell you whether it was a dream or a wish, because my real dreams about making money were really, I wanted to get out of poverty myself, which I managed to do. But I also really, you know, remember my mother's words about giving back. And I'm particularly interested in poor children and, you know, whatever their dreams might be, whether it go to a camp of their choice, or if they need a computer, or horseback riding lessons, or whatever it is. I think it's, you know, we've got so much work to do with our children. And I'm a single lady, I don't have children of my own, but I do have four nephews, but I mean our children in general in this country. So, you know, my bigger wish was to make enough money to set up a foundation, and I've since, you know, there are friends of mine and people that I've met along the way, there are programs in place that can affect children's lives in a positive way, and we really have a lot of work to do in that direction. So how do I go from where I am today, and I certainly was hurt at the time of the crash, but, you know, have rebuilt since then. And I kept thinking, you know, what is the future? And the future is, I think, water. The next gold is water. And I kept thinking I had a major source of spring water on my property. Now, my lawyers will tell you, don't ever say, they'll tell me, never tell this story because, you know, they said, who will believe it? But it's true, so I can't say something that isn't true. So I don't know whether it was, you know, that I really, how it all came, but anyway, I kept thinking, and I called my friends in Vermont, and I said, you know, I really think I have a lot of water on my property.
And this was only just
I can't tell you how it started, but it somehow started in that recovery period of laying on my back and fantasizing, because I've always had dreams, and so they said, oh, sure, Ginny, right? You know, it's a dream of yours. And then when I finally, my back healed, luckily it healed in place, and I'm now totally out of back pain, and I'm horseback riding again, and I'm skiing again, and doing it all. And but when I went back to Vermont, the feeling just kept really bothering me and getting bigger rather than going away. Now I'm healthy and I'm moving around again, and we should forget about these things. And I said, no, it's really bothering me. So they said, well, why don't you call a dowser? So I did, and I made an appointment to meet me in the post office.
Who'd
I thought
you call?
I don't know the guys. He never showed up anyway, the person that I called. And so we made a couple of appointments, and I'd drive up, and no one would be there. So finally, they said, well, let us call somebody, because maybe, you know, they don't know you, you're calling from Boston, we'll try it. But we never got a dowser over there. So finally I said, well, you know, this has reached a point where it is bothering me so much, I guess we need to hire a hydrogeologist. And so I did some research, who's the best, and I hired Heindel and Noyes. And I said to them, you know, they gave me an estimate what it would cost, and it was very costly. And I said, well, could you, and it seemed to be, you know, their studies seemed to be, you know, in stages and increments. And I said, could you work with me? Because I'm really just going on women's intuition. And if you think I'm crazy, I'm perfectly capable of handling that, and can we just stop the project? And they said, yes, we'd be happy to work with you, and we'll know fairly quickly whether, you know, you're dreaming about something or not. So they get over to the property, and they get really excited about the property. And they called me up, and they said, we want you to know we're very conservative, and we don't like to get excited about anything, because you never know until you actually drill whether you hit water or not. But we've never seen anything quite like this. So I said, well, does that mean I have water? And they said, not necessarily. So I said, well, okay, go ahead and proceed with what you're doing. And I guess they do ground tests, and they do...
What made them think that...
I don't know. There is a fracture on the property, and
what do you mean by a fracture?
Actual movement of the land, where land, you know, we think the water goes back to the last glacier age, so that there is a fracture, you know, where the land is different height. And so they proceeded, and a few weeks or a month or two later, whatever it was, they called me up and they said, well, we've located where we think the primary location is. So I said, now he's in Vermont and I'm in Boston, and I said to him, well, do you go down the old logging road, you go through the gate, you continue up the logging road, you go over Pine Brook, and continue up the hill, which is the logging road, and there's like a ravine there. And I said, and there's an old car down there. Is that what you're talking about? And he nearly fell over. I mean, after months and months of testing, I told him exactly where the spot was. So he just, you know, he just totally freaked out. And he said, yes. And so they had Minosh come up and put a couple of boreholes in, and the first borehole they broke everything. We still haven't been able to cap it properly, and the second bore, you know, they put up by the primary area, and it's the largest bedrock aquifer in the Northeast. It's the largest source of spring water. And there actually are, which you can see in the wintertime, there are springs all over the property. And you can see it in the wintertime easier because it melts the snow around where the water's coming up. You open up, there's a picture here on my refrigerator, you open up the borehole, and it's like opening up a fire hydrant.
Oh my gosh.
And it's only a 6-inch pipe, but it comes out full speed, and in the springtime it breaks the caps and comes out at, 600 gallons a minute. But they estimate, conservatively, 1,500 gallons a minute. But they really think, it's hard to know without putting bigger pipes in, which aren't necessary, the flow is more like 3,000 gallons a minute of water. And we did some preliminary time dating from the University of Waterloo. And the old component in the water goes back beyond the 1930s. So the water isn't moving down the road anyplace. It's caught in bedrock. And this spring we're going to do the final test, which will tell us the exact age of the water. So we'll know that if it did go back to the last glacier age. And the old component is really very important element. The other important element is the recharge rate. And I'll explain that a little bit. But the old component, the older the water, the purer it is, because they didn't have the pollution that we have today. So that's one of the reasons why this water is so incredibly pure. Poland Springs analyzed the source, and they were just blown away by the purity. They said, we're trying to figure out why your water is so pure. And I said, because there's nothing on the land. There's no golf course. There's no hotel. And this land is just virgin land. And the other component, of course, is the recharge. And the land was available behind the original farm. I owned sort of 3/4 of the way up the mountain. And Ward Lumber owned from my property line up and over the Northfield side and the top of Scrag Mountain, up and over the top of Scrag Mountain. So that land was for sale, and so I bought that from them, which was the protection area for the water. For instance, if there was a development, and the Northfield side has been subdividing to the top of the mountain on their side, if the development continued over, we'd have pollution. So I bought the whole protection area, so now I own almost 2,000 acres of land. And I changed, for instance, from clear cutting on the forest to selective cutting in order to preserve the purity of the water and the land, so that we didn't have erosion and so forth. The recharge, it's really important, the type of vegetation you have on the property.
What does recharge mean? Is that the water?
The new water, whether it be rain or snow or just moisture in the clouds. For instance, there's a cloud cover every morning that goes across that range. And this is one of the reasons why the hydrogeologist feels the recharge is so high. He's estimating it also to be in the range of, if you want to be very conservative, he's saying 1,500 gallons a minute, but he really thinks more closer to 3,000. Because the trees actually pull the moisture from the clouds. And, the moisture gets down into the land and goes through to the aquifer. Also, the component of the land, there's clay, there's a good thickness of clay on the property, and clay is a natural filter. So another reason why the water is so pure. So you want the history about going into the town and I would like to put a bottling plant in the town forth. And I originally went to...
So you discovered this in 1987?
87, yes. Was it 87 or 88? It must have been, you know, I bought the property in 87, so it was the next year, because I didn't go back.
Well, let me ask, have you ever had these feelings before that you knew something, or is this the first time that ever happened?
Oh, I have these feelings, yes, a lot, but and they're always right, but I never can direct it. I never know what it's going to be about, and so it's just intuition, you know. But most people have intuition if they'll listen to it. You know, you meet someone and you either like them or you're not too comfortable or whatever it is. But I've had intuition about a lot of things, and they probably would have burnt me at the stake in Salem, you know, if I was born in another time. So it has happened a lot in my lifetime. And and I've been right. And some, and even dreams, you know, some of my dreams even come true. And yeah, I could give you a lot of stories, even something that happened with my brother, and he was in the service, and I was in Switzerland skiing, and all week it was bothering me, something was happening to him, and, you know, and I kept praying, please let it happen to me and not let it happen to my brother, because I really thought my brother was going to die or something horrible. And and I ended up going off a cliff in Switzerland, and when I finally landed, I landed on the lip of the mountain, Klosters, and I was stuck in the snow. You know, I couldn't move. My skis were buried and everything. And I'm looking over the lip, and the trees were looked like ants below, and they had to come down and dig me out. And then years later, and I never talked to my brother about it, So they dug me out and I got back up, and I really could have lost my life. And then we pieced it together, and it was like 10 years later, and it was actually, my brother was in Saudi Arabia and in the service, and building roads or something, and they were out in the desert, and they ran out of gas coming back or something, or something happened to the car, whether it was a flat tire or something. And there were three guys in the truck, and they didn't know which way was the nearest. They, you know, everything's flat, they couldn't see anything, and it was getting dark. So my brother went off with a canteen of water, and they weren't sure, they just guessed the direction and went in the direction, found people, and they came back and helped them out, and he was fine. But it was the exact week that I was in Klosters, and, you know, it was so, I mean, we were just totally blown away by that. But so things like that have happened all my life, but, you know, I can't direct it. People say, well, what's going to happen here? And I wouldn't have a clue. But anyway, so I went to the town fathers and told them that I'd like to start a water company, and my dreams of having a foundation, a percentage would go into a foundation, which are still my dreams, and I plan to do that if we can ever get in business, you know, for children and also for seniors, to improve their quality of life, because everything we have has come down from them, and it's so important that we learn from our history, and we don't acknowledge that enough, and we don't take care of our senior people enough. So I think it's important to acknowledge them and recognize them and help them preserve their quality of life in their later years. And also we need to pay attention to our children, as I said, because that's our future. I'm also concerned about wildlife and preserving the family farm. And I think water is something that is natural and comes from nature. And you can't plan on where it is, And it's not going to be, if you find it in the city, it's not going to be pure. So that there has to be a reason to for people to preserve property as the farmers and land start, you know, the farmers start selling property and land starts getting subdivided. I mean, everybody all around me is subdividing now. So I went to them with my plan and looking for approval for truck, because I have to have trucks in order to get the water off the property. And they gave me a permit for 6 trucks a day.
Now, is this up the Palmer Hill Road that you go?
No, this is on Common Road.
Uh-huh.
Palmer Hill goes around and back,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it really becomes a trail.
Yes.
So the frontage on my property is Common Road,
mm-hmm,
which becomes
mm-hmm.
Long Road, I believe,
mm-hmm.
because my farm is the old Long Farm.
Mm.
And the borehole is fairly close to the road. There's fairly easy access from the old logging road.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be the only road that would have to be improved. And they had me do road impact studies and so forth. And the road, the main road is a dirt road, but it's a very well-built dirt road because there were, you know, milk farms there.
Mm-hmm.
And the farm in back of me was a milk farm. And so the history has been trucking milk, which is the same type of truck that I need to use for water. So they did, you know, we suggested the people that did the road impact study suggested a few minor improvements, which have